All right, we're going to start here on the bottom of Pei Zayin Amud Bet by the two dots. Eid Echad Me'ida Shehi Pru'ah. In the Mishnah, one of the cases was a single aid that testifies that the document, the ktubah, was already paid. She has to take a shvua in that instance in order to collect on her ktubah. Sova Rami Barcham Lameimar Shvua Deoraita. He wanted to suggest here that this is actually a shvua min haTorah, not a shvua that is imposed midrabanan to ensure that she hadn't collected already, or to make the husband calm that it wasn't a previous collection, but rather a shvua that is demanded min haTorah, dechtiv. Lo yakum eid echad b'ish, dechol avon, udechol chatat. We have the pasuk that says that a single aid may not be enough evidence to incriminate an individual, dechol avon, udechol chatat, whether it's dvarim shel yisur, whether it's dvarim shel mamon. He is unable to be the proper evidence when it comes to Isurim, when it comes to Divrei Mamon, aval kamhu l'shvua, but he does have the ability to generate a shvua. V'amarmar, kol makom sheshnai mechayvim oto mamon, and on that we have a statement which is any place where two individuals, had they testified, would be able to obligate an individual in monetary compensation, or obligate them to pay, then echad mechayivo shvua. If you have a single aid in that instance, he can generate the need for a shvua by the counterparty because of his testimony. So why don't we say the same thing over here? This single aid that comes and says that the tuba was paid already and would force her to take a shvua midoraita, because if two aidim showed up and testified over here, then we would say that the shtar is prua, that it's completely paid. So Rava says over here, similar to something that he said before, Amarova, shtei tshuvot badavar. I have two answers to this point as to why it's not a shvua d'oraita. Achado, dechol nishbaim shebetorah, nishbaim velo mishalmim. Anybody in the Torah that takes a shvua midoraita, there's only one type of shvua in the Torah, that's in lieu of payment. A shvua makes you patur. You don't take a shvua to extract money min haTorah, you only take a shvua in defense of your position. If you're obligated to pay money and you're trying to exempt yourself, that's when you take a shvua. V'hi nishbeit v'notelet. And over here, she's doing just the opposite. She's taking a shvua in order to collect her ktubah, to extract money. So in generating the shvua, an eid echad, when it generates a shvua, is in a case where that aid is obligating the individual or saying that they are pay up to pay. And then the counterparty uses a shvua to exempt themselves from the claims of that single aid. Over here is just the opposite. The aid over here is saying that she will get nothing, and she's taking a shvua to allow herself to collect in this instance. Vod, ein nishbaim al kfirat shibud karkot. There is no such thing as a shvua on the denial of something that is a lien on property. It's actually a derivative of the din of shvua. There's no such thing as a shvua on karka. That we learn out from the dinim in the Gemara and Shavuot. And the extension of that is that something that is shibud karkot, something that has a lien on the land, is the equivalent of land itself. And because of that, you cannot take a shvua on shibud karkot. This again is one of those instances. The ktubah has a lien on all the property of the husband, on his land. And therefore it would be the equivalent of taking a shvua on land. Midoraita, there is no such shvua. So how could you claim we're talking about a shvua d'oraita over here when we're talking about two things that don't appear in a shvua d'oraita? Nishba minotelet, that she's taking a shvua and collecting. And number two is, it's a shvua about, quote-unquote, karka, but shibud karkot, which is also not available in shvuot d'oraita. Ela amar rovo midrabanan. This shvua is clearly midrabanan. Kedei lapis da'ato shel baal. It's just to make the baal calm, to give him reassurance to the fact that when he's paying her, she is justified in making this collection, and that she hasn't been paid before, because we assume that she would take the shvua seriously. And if she takes the shvua, then the Baal says, all right, I gotta pay, because she must be telling the truth over here. Now, Tosafot over here raises issues that we actually discuss more in depth in the Gemara and Shvuot, which is that in terms of Shvuot d'oraita, we know of three general categories of Shvuot d'oraita. There's shvuot ha-shomrim, shvuot that are generated by a person's relationship with the other individual in watching, in renting, borrowing, one of those relationships. And then there's an incident with the object. And now the Shomer needs to take a Shavuah in order to exonerate himself from whatever transpired there. So that's what we know as Shavuot HaShomrim. Other than we also know of a Shavuah, which is Modeh B'Miksat, someone who admits to a portion of what they owe in a circumstance. That Shavuah is a Shavuah Modeh B'Miksat. That's also a Shavuah Midoraita. Now, Modeh B'Miksat and the Din of Shomrim, generally let's assume that they derive from the same Parshiot. And because of that, the rules that apply to them will be very similar, if not exactly alike. The problem is, in terms of a Shavuot Eid Echad, the Shavuot Eid Echad, as you can see, is found from a Pasuk in Sefer Dvarim, versus Shavuot HaShomrim and Modeh B'Miksat, which in all likelihood is found in Parshat Mishpatim in Sefer Shemot. So what Tosafot asks over here, and it's a more general problem in terms of the Shavuot Eid Echad, is how do we know that by a Shavuot and Eid Echad, it doesn't apply to Karkot? That's a din that we find by Shavuot HaShomrim. And you could say, at least if there's Ibur and Pashiot, it's also found by Modeh B'Miksat. But how do you get that over to Shavuot Eid Echad? How do you know that a Shavuot and Eid Echad does not apply to Karka? It's not in the same genre of Shavuot that we're talking about when we're talking about Shomrim and we're talking about Modeh B'Miksat. And he says, if you do say such a thing, then we also know that there is a machloket between Rab and Shmuel with regards to the meaning of the Mishnah and Shavuot in Modeh B'Miksat. What is the level of ta'ana, claim that you need? And what is the level of denial that you need? There's ta'anat shtei kesef and a denial of shavei prutar. Or do you need a ta'ana with a denial of shtei kesef machloket? Does that also apply to Eid Echad as well? Meaning that if Eid Echad is subject to the same rules, because we say here that you can't take a Shavuot Eid Echad by Karka, does that also mean that it's subject to the same restrictions on the level of the claim or the level of the denial over here? That is also apparent by Modeh B'Miksat. Tosafot over here discusses where exactly does Eid Echad fit. And the Rishonim in Shavuot basically are playing with that din of Eid Echad to figure out how close is it to Shavuot HaShomrim versus Shavuot Modeh B'Miksat, and how much is an independent Shavuot that is not connected to either of these two Shavuot, because again, it's found on its own. It's a diok out of the Pasuk by Shnei Edim, which doesn't have relevance to other places where we learn out the dinim of Shavuot from. And therefore, it's not clear exactly how to apply the dinim that we know by other Shavuot. From this Gemara, it seems obvious to them that Shavuot Karka would not apply by Shavuot Eid Echad, even though it's not clear where that is learned from or how we know that. So that already pushes us in a direction of looking at Shavuot Echad differently than we would have thought of in the abstract, which is it is not connected to these other two Shavuot. So then, Amar Rav Papa, Ipikeachu, if this individual, meaning the Baal here, is smart about this, Maite Lalide Shavuot Doraita, he can generate a Shavuot Doraita, he can cause a Shavuot Doraita. Yoiv La Ktubata, Pape Chad Sado, he should give her the Ktubah a second time, pay it out in front of a single aid. V'samech Sado Kamo Asado Batro. And then he'll combine the first aid. He already has one aid that he paid her the first time. And now he have an aid that he paid her the second time. Now he has two aidim that say that he paid her a ktubah. And he'll say, why are there two payments over here? I lent her money the first time. I paid out her ktubah the second time. And I have two aidim to the fact now that she was paid already. And she's got to give me back the money. Because at this point, she is not extracting money, but rather denying the need to pay him back the money. So now when this Eid Echad comes and testifies and says, oh, you gave her a ktubah originally, then a second Eid that comes along and says you gave her a ktubah the second time, she's been paid twice now. Now if she's been paid twice, the two Eidim testify to that fact. Then obviously she didn't get two ktubot. One of them was a ktubah, one of them is a loan. So basically, now what he's making a claim for is the return of the money from the milveh. So the scenario here now is, he paid her the ktubah the first time in front of an Eid Echad. She denies that ever happened. In that case, when she takes the shvuah, it remains a shvuah d'rabanan, because in that case, she's nishbeit v'notelet. She's taking a shvuah in order to claim the ktubah and to get paid again. So what he does is he takes a single aid, pays her the ktubah again, based on her denial the first time. But now, if he adds those two aidim together, he has two aidim to the fact that he paid the ktubah, and now he also has an aid that he lent her money, because if he paid the ktubah twice, she owes him money. So now that first aid will turn into an aid that he actually lent her money. Now, if she's taking a shvuah, she owes him money, and that shvuah will be a denial of payment. It'll be in lieu of payment. Then it's a shvuah d'oraita. So that's what Rav Papa is saying. He can generate it into being a shvuah d'oraita versus a shvuah d'rabanan. What's the benefit of that? Rashi claims over here that the shvuah d'oraita is b'shem, or b'kinuay, first of all, is the shem Hashem, v'chei sefer b'yado, and it requires what's called nikitat chefetz. You have to hold a holy object in your hand, whether it's a sefer Torah, mezuzah, tefillin, some sort of object of kedusha that, in a sense, enhances the shvuah and the level of shvuah versus a shvuah d'rabanan, which is what he calls here a klola b'alma, as well as lack of nikitat chefetz, that he doesn't require either of those two items. Rashi here, in describing klola b'alma, is talking about an institution of the geonim, which was to forego the need for a shvuah because they were so afraid of the shvuah sheker and the implications of Tamei Zemen taking a shvuah sheker. So rather, they created this ceremony in which they gave a klala to whoever doesn't tell the truth in these situations. And the Gonim described, when we learned the Gemara and Shavuot, we discussed this, and I think I put out the Mikorot over there, how the Gonim, they used to light candles, they'd make it dark, and it was a very, very solemn ceremony about the implications of the curse that was going to come about. But it's certainly not on the level of a shvuah. That's what Rashi claims the difference is. Tosafot and many of the Rishonim take issue with Rashi and say that's just not true. With all the shvuot that we find, even shvuot de Rabbanan, we still have nikitat chefetz, we still have a din of kinui or the shame that is said in these instances. So they say that's certainly not a difference between a shvuot de Rabbanan versus a shvuot de Oraita. And as Tosafot points out, the difference is not between de Oraita or de Rabbanan, but rather where the shvuah is found. Shvuot de Oraita, fine. Shvuot de Rabbanan that are found in the Mishnah have the same din as a shvuot de Oraita. The only time we see a difference in a shvuot de Rabbanan is a shvuot that was imposed by the Amoraim, like a shvuot Heset. Shvuot Heset was introduced much later on by the Amoraim in cases of kofar bakol. When someone denies something entirely, instead of letting them go without any shvuah, the Amoraim instituted a shvuat hesed. In order for the person to extract themselves with a denial, they would have to do a shvuah. That might be a derivative of modeh mimiktzat, where there is a shvuah d'oraita, and the migo that nobody would be kofar bakol, but once the thieves figured out that if you deny everything, you won't have to take a shvuah, so they started maybe using that, and the migo might have disappeared. So the shvuat hesed came in to solve or plug that hole in the system. So that shvuah that say, that shvuah de Rabbanan, yes, maybe the difference that Rashi's talking about exists. But a shvuah that's found in the Mishnah, like the shvuah that we're talking about over here, clearly has the same dinim as a din d'oraita in terms of the shame and in terms of nikitat chefetz. As the Tosafot read, articulates over here, Veinu Nirli, the ben shvuah de oraita, ben shvuah de Rabbanan, shvuah chetzet, bein an hashem. Ok, bechad mine kinuim, need the shem Hashem, or one of the kinuim. Ben b'nehem efresh, elosh azu b'niket chayfetz, vizu enu b'niket chayfetz. And the only difference between a shvuah teseit and a shvuah d'oraita is whether you have to hold an object of mitzvah in your hand. V'kach peirush Rabbeinu hai gaon, v'sefer mishpatei shvuot shechiber. V'kach mefreshim kol ha-gaonim. That's what all the gaonim say. V'davka shvuah teseit. That's only true by shvuah teseit, shlo nitkana elo bimei amoraim. Because it was a very late institution. But any shvuah that is mentioned in a Mishnah or Braita requires the holding of a object of mitzvah, because they put those together like the shvuah d'oraita. And all the gaonim explain it this way, and therefore he feels that Rashi's explanation here is incorrect. And therefore the Rishonim come up with all sorts of other differences. Here Tosafot talks about apich shvuah, the ability to flip the shvuah to the other party. Also, dinim like chashud al shvuah, if someone is chashud to lie in a shvuah, what do we do in those instances? Are they automatically chayav? Or can we ask the counterparty to take the shvuah instead of them? Which is similar to the concept of apich shvuah, it's a derivative of that. So in all those instances, there are differences between shvuah d'oraita and shvuah d'rabbanan, and that's what the Rishonim point out. There still are differences between shvuah d'oraita and shvuah d'rabbanan, and the shvuah d'oraita will help him out in this case because it's a, according to Rashi, a much more severe shvuah. But even according to the other Rishonim, it's a much tighter shvuah. And in being tighter, if there are ways for her to slip out or to not take the Shvuah. In case of Doraita, it would force her to be Chayevet automatically, whereas by Ketubah, it might force him to take the Shvuah, or flip the Shvuah, or the obligation onto him. Others just to suggest that just wants to add on another Shvuah. If you want to force her to take two different Shvuot over here, just increase the intensity of the lie. If she's going to lie here, then we'll force her to take two Shvuot, so it's a much more serious issue in her eyes. So that's what Rav Papa suggests over here. Then Matkiv Lo Rav Shisha Breid Ravidi, Heich Samich Sadakama Asadabatro. How can you have one aid be put together with another aid? Meaning that they are witnessing two different events. One witnessed the first payment of the ketubah. One witnessed the second payment of the ketubah. The two of them did not necessarily witness the same event. How can you be mitzarif them into a single entity, a single kat edim? Even though, as Tosafot points out here, that happens to be a machloket. He says, "Chema, my kashale plugtahi beperek zeh aborer halva achar halva imitzarif edikeman damar lo beinin riyakechad." There's someone who says you don't have to see together. You don't have to be at the same event together. They're both testifying that she got paid her ketubah. But you're right, over here it might be slightly different because we are considering them, or maybe they know that they're discrete events. So maybe in that instance they can't be mitzdarif. Although Tosafot feels that it was close enough to that case in Sanhedrin that there are possibilities of that. But here the Gemara says that you cannot do that. You cannot bring them together. El Amar of Shisha Brei Dervidi. That he will bring the original aid that witnessed the first time he paid and be mitzarif to him an additional aid. So now there'll be two aidim for the second payment, including the aid that was there at the first payment. And then he'll make the first one into a halva again. So when he pays the ketubah the second time, he has two aidim to that fact that he paid the ketubah the second time. Now he has one aid to the fact that he paid the ketubah the first time. But now it cannot be a ketubah, because there's a deem that she was paid a ketubah the second time. So the first one must have been a loan. If it's a loan and you have one aid telling you it's a loan, she owes him money. She owes him money. She says, "I don't owe you anything." The aid says, "Yes, you do owe him money. He gave you money that first time." That's a shvuah d'oraita, where she's denying the need to pay money in that case. So that's the way that you generate the shvuah d'oraita. Now Rashi over here says that he doesn't necessarily have to bring the original aid and be mitzarif with another aid. He says just a matter of convenience. He could have brought two aidim from the shuk and had them testify about the second tubah. There's no benefit in having the first aid be mitzarif to the party here to make it to the second aid, because they're two separate aidiot now. There's an aidot about the ketubah. You just need two aidim for that. There's the single aid who testifies about the first ketubah. So Rashi says that it's just a matter of convenience to bring that aid in, since he's going to have to testify anyway, so you may as well bring him in with one other aid, and you'll only need two aidim instead of three aidim. But now her denial, instead of being simply a denial of payment of ketubah, which would only generate a shvuah derabanan, now she's denying a loan, which would be a shvuah deoraita. And because you have an aid echad testifying that she did get the loan, and therefore she would have to take a shvuah deoraita, and that's what we're trying to generate over here, a shvuah deoraita. So matkiv la Rav Ashi. So Rav Ashi asks a question similar to what you were suggesting before. Kati yicholim emimar beit ktubot havai. I had two ktubot. This woman can claim that I had two ktubot, and he was paying me out each time on my ktubah, and that there was actually no loan here, and I owe him no money whatsoever. And therefore, now he'll be trapped into paying a third time, because she'll say, "I had two ktubot, and I gave him the ktubah back when he paid me, and then he still owes me for the first ketubah, which he is denying. And now I'm going to take a shvuah that he owes me for that ketubah." And now he ends up paying three times instead of two times. So in that instance, this doesn't help him. It's actually going to hurt him. Instead of paying once and then having her take a shvuah and maybe have to pay twice, he's now going to end up having to pay three times, because she'll claim that she has two ketubot. And the fact that he came and paid her a second time is evidence to the fact that she has two ketubot. Otherwise, why did he give her a second payment that was called the payment for ketubah? Even the first aid agrees that the first payment was for ketubah, but now he says, "Oh, no, I didn't mean it as a ketubah, it was for a loan. Because look, I paid you the second time as your ketubah." She says, "No, you paid me for ketubah each time. I actually had two ketubot, and I'll prove it to you, because you came and said twice. In front of one aid, you said you paid me a ketubah. In front of two aidim, you said pay me a ketubah. So I really have two ketubot that you owe me for." Now, how did the woman end up with two ketubot? That could come for a number of reasons. One is the possibility that he divorced her and remarried her, even though we saw earlier in the Mishnayot that he can rely on the original ketubah. In that case, if it has yet to be paid out, But in cases where it was already paid out, then the first ketubah is null and void. But he could also write her a second ketubah in that instance, even when the first ketubah is still outstanding. Could be a case where we saw earlier in the Masechta he wanted to add money on to the ketubah, or the Tosefta ketubah. So he wrote her a first ketubah that was smaller from the first date, and wrote her a second ketubah that was much larger from the second date. And other possibility is that he wanted to give her two ketubot, because it was too big a sum to put in one ketubah, so he wanted to break it up into two ketubot. Whatever the reasons are, she could end up with two ketubot. And her claim is actually a strong claim over here, because he actually paid her twice for a ketubah, and now he's going to end up in a situation in which the aid is actually helping her. Because the Edim are both saying that he paid her a ketubah, which seemingly indicates she had two ketubot, and none of this was a milveh, none of this was a loan. Ella, Amar Rav Ashi, this is the solution. Who? The modeh lehu. That's only if the husband himself agrees or says that she does not have two ketubot. Now, how does that work? It's either in an instance where when the husband comes to make the second payment, he declares in front of the Edim, do, you should know that I already paid the ketubah. And the only reason I'm paying this second time is because I'm trying to force a shua de oraita. So by declaring to the second Edim that he's paying this second time, not because of a ketubah, but only to generate the chiyuv de oraita, then the second Edim cannot corroborate her story that she has two ketubot over here. He made it clear the second time he paid was only to reinforce his claim from the first time and not to create a second claim of ketubah. So that's the way Rashi describes it over here, that he makes a declaration to the Edim that he informs them as to what he's doing before he does it, and therefore the Edim no longer support her story that there was a payment for ketubot over here. Others suggest that he speaks to the woman in front of the Edim, that it's not enough that he declares it to the Edim, but rather he says to the woman, I'm paying you this second time, and therefore the first one will be deemed a halva'ah. So he makes it clear to the woman when she accepts the second payment that it's for the ketubah, and that means that the first one was a halva'ah, and therefore she can't come back with the claim that she has two ketubot. He'll say, I think you got paid. I'm giving you this not because I didn't think I paid you before. I'm doing this again because that will force the first case to be a milveh, and then you're going to have to take a shua to deny that rather than a shua to be notel. He can describe what he's doing in a case where the woman will take the money because she's getting her ketubah. She has to take a shvua either way. It's a question of the nature of the shvua. She might want to take it anyway because she'll figure if she doesn't take the money, she's not going to get it later. So there is reason for her to take the money here, even though he explains to her what he's doing, and it's going to force a shvua. She thinks she's telling the truth, so she doesn't think there's any issue over here. And therefore, the claim of two ketubot will not be upheld. Rashi over here says, "Demilta lo shichahu." It's not a normal thing. It's not something that many women have two ketubot. Now, in a case where she says it, and the Edim corroborate that, because he has two sets of Edim saying that she got her ketubah, they will give her the claim. But in a case where we don't have evidence of that, then her claim, we're not going to uphold a claim like that, because it's so uncommon for a woman to have two ketubot. All right. Minechasim mishubadim. It says that in order to collect from encumbered property, property that he sold and she wants to take it away from the kuchot, that she has to take a shvua in order to get the ketubah. It's not hotam. We have a mishnah over there in Shvot. V'chein yitomim lo yifru ela b'shvua. Same is true by yitomim, by the orphans, those that are left over with the estate. They cannot collect their father's outstanding loans except with a shvua. Miman. Who are they collecting from? Who has the father lent money to that they want to collect and that they need to take a shvua in order to collect? Ilei mami loveh. If you're saying that they're coming to collect from the debtor has to pay this money. They have the shtar that shows that the debtor owes money. And now they're coming to collect it. You're saying they have to take a shvua. Hashtar v'en shakil below shvua. If their father showed up with the shtar and said, you owe me money, the loveh would have to pay the money without the creditor, the father, taking a shvua. V'inu b'shvua. So then why would we obligate them to take a shvua when their father wouldn't need to take a shvua in that instance? They have a shtar. The debtor owes the money. There's no reason to believe that this shtar was paid. Elohi kamar. V'chene yitomim, mina yitomim. This is a case where both the creditor and the debtor passed away. So now the creditor's children are coming to the debtor's children and saying, pay up the loan. We have a shtar here that says your father owes the money. We'd like you to pay it. Lo yifru elav shvua. In that case, they have to take a shvua. Amar Rav Zikra, Amar Rav Yehuda. Let's explain the nature of this shvua, which is lo shanu elishamru yitomim if the debtor's children say, Amar lanu abba, liviti uparati. I borrowed money and I paid it back. So the debtor's children are saying, yes, I did borrow the money. They're agreeing to it. And they're saying, uparati, I paid it back. So in that instance, the creditor's children have to take a shvua that their father never said that this shtar was paid out. If the, say my father said I never borrowed the money, he denies the whole thing entirely. So then, af bishvua lo yifru. Then they can't collect, even with a shvua they can't collect. So now, matkif lo rova, other abo. It should be just the opposite. The logic here is backwards. Kol omer lo leviti, kol omer lo parati dami. Anybody who denies the loan, in essence, is also saying I didn't repay the loan. They have a shtar that says there was a loan here. So when debtor's children say the debtor said he never borrowed the money, then if he never borrowed the money, he certainly didn't pay it back. And they're standing here with a shtar that says that they should get paid. So how could you say over here when they say, oh, we never borrowed the money, don't have to pay anything. No shvua, no payment, nothing happens. You have a shtar evidencing a loan, and they say, there was no loan. They're going up against the shtar. They don't have that power. And it's clear they didn't pay it back, because when you say I didn't borrow, it means I didn't pay it back. Ela itmar, hachi itmar. This is what you have to say. Amar Rav Zikra, Amar Rav Yehuda, lo shanu lo shamru yitomim, amar lanu abba liviti uparati. That's only in a case where the father says, I borrowed the money and I paid it back. So in that instance, we force a shvua from the creditor's children to say that the creditor never told them that this shtar was repaid, and then they'd have to pay out. Aval, amru, amar lanu abba lo liviti. If they say that our father said he never borrowed the money, that the children of the debtor say that the debtor said he never borrowed the money, nifrein shelo b'shvua. Then they gotta pay even without a shvua because exactly what we said before, lo liviti means lo parat. They didn't pack it back and it's up against a shtar. Against the shtar, they have no power. Shekol omer lo liviti, komer lo parati dami. Anybody who says I didn't borrow it means I didn't pay it back. If they have a shtar, they gotta pay up. Okay, so the good question here about why does the debtor's statement have any power here whatsoever? It's against the shtar. There's a shtar which is clear evidence of the fact that there was a loan over here. And had he paid the money back, the shtar should have been ripped up or he should have a receipt somewhere. So why does the fact that the debtor told his children on his deathbed that, yes, I borrowed the money, but I paid it back, why does that generate a shvua? Why is there a necessity for a shvua all of a sudden? Just because of his claim. There's a full-fledged shtar here that says he owes the money. So that comes to the nature of someone on their deathbed, which is that we believe that people on their deathbed tell the truth. That when a person's about to face their creator, then all of a sudden they start to tell the truth, and they give up all their secrets or their lies for a little time. And we actually see this today from many people in Poland, in other areas who are actually Jewish and hid their Jewishness for many years because of the Holocaust or post the Holocaust. And then on their deathbed, they announce to the children that they're really Jewish and tell them they're Jewish after they've been practicing Catholics for many years. Why all of a sudden on their deathbed did they say something? Why not go to the grave with the lie? It's because when a person goes to their creator, they feel a certain compelling necessity to tell the truth. And so because of that, the word of a person when they're on their deathbed takes on extra power, and we give it some sort of credence or credibility that will force a shvua in this case, even though it's going up against a shtar. It produces all sorts of interesting cases. There's a case that I spoke about in the past in the Gemara in Kiddushin about a butcher on his deathbed who thinks he's about to die. And on his deathbed, they call on the rabbi and he says to the rabbi that I've been shechting and many of the things that I shechted were treifot. And he wants to have a vidui and a kapara for the fact that he's been serving treifot to all these people. But unfortunately for him, he didn't die. And it gets better and he denies the whole thing. So over there, and we discussed exactly this case. When a person thinks they're on the deathbed, how do they talk? And do then we give extra credibility to what they said? And when he comes and denies it later, it's him versus the rabbi. The only person in the room when he made the admission was the Rav. So now, who's believed in that instance? Anyway, very interesting case that's discussed by the Pitchei Tshuva. Now, why does he speak about the fact that he never borrowed the money? Because he's trying to close out all of his transactions. He knows that there are outstanding transactions out there, and therefore he makes a comment about all those things. People on their deathbed, especially in those days, used to close out all their accounts, and they wanted to make sure that everything was well known. So that's why he discussed, even though nobody had claimed, he says, I never borrowed that money, because he knows the guy's holding a shtar over there. So he wants to make a claim or close out his accounts with regards to that. So that's why he's discussing all these issues on his deathbed. All right, now, b'nifrei shelo b'fanav, lo tifrei delo b'shvua. She comes to collect not in front of him, meaning that she wants her ktubah, and her husband is not available to make the claim against her to say anything, then we demand she takes the shvuah in order to collect. Amravacha, Sara Bira, Maseba, Lifne Rabbi Yitzchak, Antochia. There was an incident that came before Rabbi Yitzchak in Antochia, Vamar, Loshanu el Ktubat Isha. This is a special dispensation for the ktubah, Mishum China, because of Chain. Again, we've discussed this many times. Rashi and Tosafot argue exactly what the chain is, but the idea being that we want to make it easy for the women to get paid out on their ktubot. If it's easy for them to get paid out on their ktubot, they'll be more likely to get married, or on the other hand, they'll be more likely to have a good marriage because they know that they're not going to be held up in the end, or they're not going to get trapped in the end. So what we do is we create certain circumstances or frameworks which facilitate her ability to get her ktubah. One of those is this case over here, where the husband is not available, is not around. Now, seemingly the husband's alive over here, because the fact that he's not present, that she's taking a shvuah. And generally, when we talk about chayin, that's only dealing with an almana, a widow, not a grusha. But over here, it might apply to both of them, because a woman who goes into the marriage over here, she's not planning to be a grusha. But by doing this, she knows that if that happens, or that circumstance happens, she is protected, and it might have application also for an almana. So because of that, we wanted to facilitate her ability to claim the ktubah. So what did we do? We made sure that in a case where the husband's not available, she can go into Beit Din, take a shvuah, and collect her ktubah. But that means in cases of a creditor and a debtor, where the debtor is not available and the creditor wants to collect, he won't be able to go into Beit Din, take a shvuah, and collect on his debts, because the debtor is not available, and we won't allow that to happen. Aval b'chov lo. And that's what it means here. The ktubah, yes. B'chov, no. Rav Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman, who is a dayan. And Rav Nachman, who is also involved with the idea of the shvuah teseit, and certain issues that come up, you see that Rav Nachman, who is a dayan, is very key in making these decisions, and he says, look, I know from my cases that what's going to happen here is, afilu bal chov. Even a bal chov, you could do this. Why? It's very simple. What are people going to do? They're going to borrow money and then take off and go away. Then the creditor has no way to make a claim over here because he can't get to extract the money without the debtor being present. And since the debtor's not present, he can't get his money back, and now the guy's stuck. And what are you doing is basically facilitating these charlatans to borrow money and then take off after they borrow the money. And if that happens one too many times, people will stop lending money out. You're going to close down the liquidity in the market because creditors are going to be afraid that they're not going to get their money back, or they're going to be unable to get repayment of their loans. So in order to facilitate a liquid market, we have to allow creditors to make claims and come with a shvuah in order to collect. Now, many of the Rishonim believe that the locha is like Rav Nachman. For a number of reasons, Rav and Rav Nachman are Batra. Since they are Batra, they're later Amoraim, the locha should be like them. As well as the fact that Rav Nachman is a Dayan. So in many cases that deal with Dinim like this, the locha is like Rav Nachman. And they believe that the locha is like him. But if you look in the Tosafot brings from the Rabbeinu Chananel, and he himself seems to support this, that he says, Masim b'chol yom, she'en mochrim shelo b'fanav v'bal chov. We don't sell the debtor's property on behalf of the creditor if the debtor is not present. And so basically the Rabbeinu Chananel says that nobody worries about this din of Rav Nachman. They base it, Tosafot says, on a Yerushalmi. From the Yerushalmi, it seems that Rav Nachman's din was not upheld by the Yerushalmi, and the Yerushalmi seems to indicate that the halacha is not like Rav Nachman. On the other hand, the Bavli, as Tosafot points out, in a Gemara in Arachin, seems to indicate that it supports Rav Nachman's Shita. Because the Gemara over there brings Rav Nachman's Shita as a question in the Gemara, assuming that Rav Nachman is clearly right. And so what many see here is a machloka between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, and therefore a question as to how we paskin. Do we paskin like the Bavli, which normally is the case, that we paskin, again, like Rav Nachman is a Batra, plus like the Bavli versus the Yerushalmi. So it seems like the halacha should be like Rav Nachman, but on the other hand, the Rabbeinu Chananel says that nobody worries about this Rav Nachman, and there's somech on this Yerushalmi to say that the creditors cannot make a collection on the debtor's property in the absence of the debtor. Now, it's clear here that the only case where Rav Nachman would allow this is in a case where the loan took place in this location, and the debtor's property is in this location, and the person comes to Beitdin and says the debtor disappeared, I'm not getting my money back, I want to make a claim. What you can't do is you can't have a creditor go to another location where the debtor has property and go into Beitdin and say, I'm taking a shvuah, I want my money back, because then the creditor's going after the debtor's property in other locations. There we won't let him do it without the debtor being present, because over here the creditor's coming from a different location and trying to extract property. Over there there's a more of a likelihood that there could be something askew, something that is not necessarily clean, and that's why we won't allow it to happen. But in a case where the locus of the loan was the same place where the property of the debtor is, and the debtor disappeared, then we worry about the fact that the debtor is trying to avoid repayment, and we would allow him to take it with shvuah, according to those Rishonim that say we do take it with the shvuah. According to those that say no, then they have this process by which they ask the debtor to show up. They might ask him 3 times to come, and if he doesn't show up, then they will allow him to collect the shvuah. There are all sorts of methods for trying to get the debtor to play ball if he's not present, if he's not showing up to the Beit Din for the creditor to collect his money. All right, Rabbi Shimon Omer calls man shetovat ktubata. So Rabbi Shimon, at the end of the Mishnah, says that anytime she collects her ktubah, that the Yorshim can force her to take a shvuah. She doesn't collect her ktubah, the Yorshim can't force her to take a shvuah. Question is, on what is Rabbi Shimon? What's the reference point for Rabbi Shimon's statement? And that the Gemara is going to discuss here. Rabbi Shimon, on which part of the Mishnah is Rabbi Shimon going? So Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah, it's going on this. V'nifreit shelo b'fanav, lo tifrei le b'shvuah. She makes a claim without the presence of the husband, then she has to take a shvuah to collect. Lo shna le mizonei, v'lo shna le ktubah. Doesn't matter why she's coming to collect money or sell her husband's property to monetize it for money. Doesn't matter if it's to support her to get mizonot, because he left her without mizonot. Doesn't matter if she's coming to collect her ktubah. In either instance, she's entitled to take a shvuah and collect the, or sell the property or collect the money in order to facilitate either one of these payments. V'ata Rabbi Shimon LeMeimar, kozman shetuvat ktubata, yorsha mashbin ota. That any time she demands her ktubah, then the Yorshim can force a shvuah. Eina tovat ktubata, if she's not asking for ktubah, then any Yorshim mashbin ota. Then they cannot force her to take a shvuah. In essence, if it's for mizonot, then they cannot force the shvuah. And they argue in this machloket between Chanan and the Bnei Kohanim Gedolim. Tatan. We have a Mishnah further on in the Masechta. Mishalach lemitinat hayam vishtao tovat mizonot. And his wife is claiming mizonot. Chanan omer tishava. She has to take a shvuah in order to collect the mizonot. Tishava besof velo tishava betchila. She only has to take a shvuah in the end. In the end, meaning when she collects her ktubah, then at that point in time, she has to take a shvuah that whatever monies she used before were for mizonot, and she didn't keep any of that money that would have been in lieu of payment of her ktubah because she already took money for her ktubah. V'lo tishavah b'tchila, but she doesn't take a shvuah up front when she does it for the mizonot. Nechluku ala b'nei kohanim gedolim. The b'nei kohanim gedolim argued on Chanan, v'amro tishavah b'tchila b'sof. She takes a shvuah both in the beginning and the end, meaning she takes a shvuah for the mizonot, and secondly, she takes a shvuah for the ktubah. So this lines up with our machloket as well. The Tana Kama says that she takes a shvuah for mizonot, and she takes a shvuah for ktubah. That's similar to the B'nai Kohanim Gedolim. On the other hand, Rabbi Shimon says she only takes a shvuah for ktubah, not for mizonot. That's similar to Chanan. Mat kipla Rav Sheshet, ha yorshim mashbin ota. Beitin mashbin ota mi baile. What does this have to do with the Yorshim? This has nothing to do with the Yorshim. This all has to do with Beitin. She's coming to Beitin to sell the property of her husband, to monetize it, in order to get monies to pay for him his own oath and to pay for her ktubah. The husband's not present. So he's either passed away or he's overseas. And now she's making a claim here and Beitin's intervening to sell the property. So who's going to compel the shvuah over here? Nothing to do with the Yatomim or the Yorshim. It has to do with the Beit Din. The Beit Din, if they're going to act on her behalf, has to force her to take a shvuah to know that they can act on her behalf properly. So then why does Rabbi Shimon say that the Yorshim compel a shvuah over here? That's nothing to do with the Yorshim. According to your explanation, it's Beit Din that is compelling the shvuah over here. El Rav Sheshet, aha. It's going on this part of the Mishnah. Halcha mikever ba'ala the Beit Avia. She went from her husband's grave straight back to her father's house. She goes back to her father-in-law's house. and she's never appointed to run the estate. She doesn't deal with the estate whatsoever. Eina Yorshim Mashbim Ota. Then the Yorshim cannot force her to take a Shvuah because she never did anything with regards to the estate. We discussed in that previous Mishnah at the end of Pei Vav Amud Bet, Rashi claims over there that's where the husband gave her a right not to take a Shvuah on his part of the Apitropia, whereas other Rishonim believe that's even in a case where he didn't grant her that right, but the fact that he passed away without asking her for Shvuah means that he was Mochel on the Shvuah, and the Yorshim have no right then to go back and ask her to take a Shvuah on the work she did while her husband was alive. And at this point, they have no right to ask her for Shvuah because she's doing nothing with the estate at this point in time. So that's in that instance. On the other hand, if she does become a manager of the estate afterwards, Yorshim Mashbino Tala Atid Lavov in Mashbino Tala Mashavar. The Yitomim have a right to ask her for a Shvuah prospectively from the moment she became an Apitropia for the new estate for them. When she's acting on their behalf, they can demand a Shvuah, but they cannot then force a Shvuah on what she did for their father previous to that point in time. Whether it's through Gilgul Shvuah or not, they don't have a right to ask for that Shvuah. V'ata Rabbi Shimon Meimar, Kozman Shutuvat K'tubata, Yorshim Mashbino Ta. If she comes to ask for a K'tubah, then the Yorshim have a right to ask for a Shvuah. Eina Tovat K'tubah, Eina Yorshim Mashbino Ta. Then the Yorshim have no right to ask for a K'tubah. That's where Rashi says over here, the first Rashi. It's a case where the father asked her to be the Apitropos. Not only did he ask her to be the Apitropos when he was alive, he also said, when I pass away, he appoints her to be the manager of the estate after his death, to manage it for the Yorshim. So she's actually appointed as an Apitropia of the estate, not because of the Yitomim, but because of the father. And so she's placed in here because of the mate asked her to take care of the estate after he passed away. So in that instance, do the Yorshim have a right to ask for a Shvuah? So what the Tanakhama seemingly says is yes. As long as she's working over here, she's got to take a Shvuah. On the other hand, Rabbi Shimon says that's not the case. If she doesn't ask for a K'tubah, then she's simply working as an Apitropia appointed by the husband who passed away. She doesn't have to take a Shvuah whatsoever. On the other hand, if she wants her K'tubah, now she's already trying to make a claim against the estate to take a K'tubah. At that point, they can ask her for a Shvuah, and they can roll into that the Shvuah on her work on the estate. Now, what does it have to do? Become Miflegei. And they are. But Kamiflegei Beplukta Dabashov Rabbanan. They're arguing. Beplukta Dabashov Rabbanan. They're arguing at the same machlok between Abashov and the Rabbanan. It's not. Again, another Mishnah. Apitropos Sheminehu Avi Yitomim in Shabbat. If the father of the Yitomim appointed someone to be the executor of the estate on behalf of the Yitomim, he has to take a Shavuah. Minehu Beitin Lo Yishabbat. If Beit Din appoints him to be the executor of the estate, he does not have to take a Shvuah. The reason being that if the father appointed him to be the executor of the estate, he only would have agreed to that because he owed the father some favor. And since he owed the father some favor, he's doing this, in a sense, as repayment for that favor, and he would do it. Whether we ask him to take a Shvuah or not, he's going to do it because he owes the father a favor. And therefore, when we ask him to take a Shvuah, that won't stop him from doing the work or the executing of taking care of the estate. On the other hand, if Beit Din is looking for volunteers to come along and be the executor of the estates on behalf of the Yitomim, then people are not going to work for Beit Din if Beit Din is going to force them into a position where they have to take a Shvuah. So if Beit Din appoints the individual, we're not going to compel a Shvuah, because then you're not going to find people who are going to be willing to volunteer to do this on behalf of the Beit Din to be the executor of the estates for the Yitomim. Abba Sholomer Chilufa Dvarim. Abba Shol says just the opposite. Minu Beit Din Yishava. If Beit Din appoints him, then he does take a Shvuah. Minu Avi Yitomim, lo Yishava. But if the father of Yitomim appointed him, then he shouldn't take a Shvuah. Why is that? If the father appointed him, then Abba Shaul believes it's because he wants to do a favor. His friend was passing away. He wants to make him feel comfortable. He wants to know that it's in good hands when it goes after that. If we want to have this individual keep the word of the mate, then we're not going to force or compel him to take a Shvuah, because otherwise he won't do this. People are not going to be willing to do this in these instances. On the other hand, when Beit Din appoints him to be the executor of the estate, He will be willing to take a shvua because being appointed by Beit Din is like a stamp of approval over your integrity. Beit Din only appoints people who have strong integrity. It's almost a de facto approval of this individual to be someone who's trustworthy. And that stature is worth something to him that he's willing even to take a shvua because now he's trusted by Beit Din. He's a trusted partner with Beit Din. And so therefore he will be willing to take a shvua. So now, Rabbi Shimon, Ka'aba Shaul. Rabbi Shimon holds like Abba Shaul that when the father appoints the executor, they don't have to take a shvua. So to over here, where he appointed his wife to be the executor of the state afterwards, they, Yitomim, have no right to demand a shvua until she asks for Tubah. V'rabbonon, k'rabbonon. And the Tanakamu says, yes, she takes a shvua here when she's the apitropia of the estate, even though it was appointed by the father, because that's like the Rabbanon over here also say, that he only did it because he owed the father something, and he's going to do it, whether he has to take a shvua or not, because he owed him something, and therefore it won't be a problem. So that's the difference between them. So now, it's clear here, and as Tosfot points out, to reaffirm what Rashi says, that the father appointed her as the apitropia, Tosfot says something interesting. It's clearly a social norm at the time. It says, Matit and Gugon Shemina Balo, it has to be a case where the husband appointed her, Lachar Mita, after his death, that she should be the apitropia. Tibitzivui Beit Din Lekele Ukma. You can't say that Beit Din appointed her to be the executor of the estate. Ein Meidim and Ashima Pitropsot. That a Beit Din would never make a woman as an executor of the estate. So because of that, Tosfot says it's clear that they believe here that the reason she was empowered was by the father and not by the Beit Din. Because a Beit Din would never empower a woman to be the executor of the estate. I mean, Rashi said it already, not because of the reasons that Tosfot said, but because it makes sense in the layout of the Gemara. But Tosfot reinforces that by saying, it must be that our Mishnah is talking in a case where he appointed her, because the only way she could have become an apitropsot is if, again, the husband asked her to be so, because the Beit Din would never intervene to ask her to do such a thing. The Gemara continues, and now Matkifla Abaye. Abaye says, Hai kol zman shutovat kedubata. Great. He says in the Mishnah, Rabbi Shimon says, anytime she asks for the ketubah, she's got to take a shvuah. Im tovat mi ba'ile. It should say, if she asks for a ketubah. The way that Rav Sheshit has structured it now, it's a question of if. It's not a question of she must, but rather if she asks for a ketubah, then she must take a shvuah. If that's what Rabbi Shimon was saying, that only if she asks for a ketubah, then she takes a shvuah, that's what he should have said in his language. Im, if she takes it. But when he says kol zman comes to say that I'm asking her to do something that the Tanakhama didn't ask. Tanakama didn't ask for this much, but I say Kolzman, anytime she asks for a ketubah, you gotta take a shvua. As if the Tanakama said that not every time that she asks for a ketubah, she needs a shvua. Therefore, the language does not match the circumstance that you're creating in the Mishnah, or what Rabbi Shimon seems to be speaking about. Elamar Abaye, so now Abaye comes up with the third speculation as to what Rabbi Shimon's speaking about. Aha! It's going on this part of the Mishnah. Katam la neder shvua inli alayich. If he says that I have no right to ask you for a neder or shvua, eino yachol hashpia. He's not allowed to make her take a shvua. Neder shvua inli velo yorshai, velo abayim birshuti. That I have no right, my inheritors have no right, and anybody who acts on my behalf has no right, alayich, to ask you, v'al yorshayich, or your inheritors, v'albayim birshuteich, or anybody who comes and acts on your behalf, for a shvua, ein yachol hashbia, then he cannot ask her for a shvua. Lo who? Not him, below your shav, not his, your shim, the yitomim, below abayim bishuto, and not anybody who's acting on his behalf who has power of attorney or purchased the property from him. Lo he, they can ask of her, below your sheha, not of her inheritors, below abayim bishuta, and not anybody comes on her behalf. So there is no ability to ask for a shvua in this circumstance, period. There is an exception to the rule. The one exception to the rule is when she comes to ask for a ketubah, then the Yorshim have a right to ask her for a shvuah. And they argue beplukta the Abba Shaul ben Ema Miriam in the machloka between Abba Shaul ben Ema Miriam v'rabbonon that we saw in yesterday's daf, which is yesterday we had Amar Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel mishum Abba Shaul ben Ema Miriam. Of Alma said, "Shariyam Amru Chachamim, Abali Parah Min Nechsei Yitomim, Lo Yiparah Ela Bishvua." That if you want to come and make a collection against the Yitomim, you got to make a Shvua. And Amar Rabbi Nachman Shmuel, Locha k'benema Miriam, the Locha is like him, even though he made all these promises. This is an exception to the rule because there's a demand by the Chachamim that you're not allowed to extract anything from the Yorshim without a Shvua. So over here, when she comes to collect her Ketubah, basically what Rabbi Shimon is saying, the Locha is like Abishol ben Miriam. And since the Locha is like Abishol ben Miriam, that when you collect your Ketubah, you got to take a Shvua. Even if though he granted her all of these exemptions for the Shvua, that is still an exception to the rule and you will have to take a Shvua. So Rabbi Shimon holds like Abishol ben Ema Miriam. The Rabbonon hold like the Rabbonon, which is that even in that case, he gave her an exemption. That exemption will be granted her whether or not she is collecting her Ketubah or whether she's involved in any other issues with the Yitomim or with the husband. Matkiflo Rav Papa Hatinach. That makes sense for the first statement of Rabbi Shimon. First statement of Rabbi Shimon is Kozman Shotovat Ketubah Eino Tovat Ketubata Elo Bishvuah. That part of his statement you've explained. But there's a second half to Rabbi Shimon's statement, which is Eino Tovat Ketubata. If she doesn't ask for a Ketubah, then she doesn't have to take a Shvuah. Now, if that is simply a reverse, the other side of the first statement, then he wouldn't have to say it. It's clear here that if he says, if you take your Ketubah, anytime you take your Ketubah, you take a Shvuah, that means I would have obviously known that if she didn't take her Ketubah, you don't need to take a Shvuah. Why does Rabbi Shimon then come and make the second statement, which is, that the Yoshim have no right to give her a Shvuah? Why would you even think they have a right to take a Shvuah? That's Pshito. That's the exact opposite of the first statement, and it's obvious. Rabbi Papa says, according to you, Abaye, there's no meaning to that second statement. It says over here, so again, in a case where the positive statement, you've explained it. The negative statement, you haven't explained it. And therefore, Ella, so Ella over here means that he's coming up with another explanation for Rabbi Shimon applies. The fourth explanation of this, Amar Papa Lafuke Mid Rabbi Eliezer Umachlukato, comes to deny or to object to the position of Rabbi Eliezer and Machlukato that we saw on the Mishnah on the Pei Vav Amud Bet, which is that a person who makes his wife into a chenbanit or an apotropia, the Tanakhama says he can ask her to take a shvua whenever he wants. Rabbi Eliezer said he can even make her take a shvua on Isata and Pilcha, even over trivial items that he gives her out of the estate to work with, or items that she deals with, he can ask her for a shvua. So now Rav Papa comes along and says, this statement, that second statement, Rabbi Shimon is coming to deny that position. Now, Rashi says over here that Rav Papa accepts Abaye and builds on Abaye. So what Rashi says is, the first statement of Rabbi Shimon is what Abaye said. That if she comes along and asks for a ketubah, that's like the din of Abishol ben Ema Miriam, which is that to take a shvuah in that instance, even though she was exempted from a shvuah, if she wants to collect her ketubah. Then the second statement of Rabbi Shimon adds on another dimension, which is, if she doesn't ask for a ketubah, she doesn't have to take a shvuah at all. What does that mean, that she doesn't have to take a shvuah at all? That comes to eliminate that position of the Tanakhama and Rabbi Eliezer. Both the Tanakam and Rabbi Eliezer say that if he appoints her as an apitropos, or he appoints her as a chenvanit, he can ask her for a shvua anytime he wants. Rabbi Eliezer says you can even ask her on pilcha and isata. Along comes Rav Papa and says that that's what Rabbi Shimon says. If she doesn't ask for a ketubah, she takes no shvuot. No shvuot whatsoever when she doesn't ask. Eina tovat ketubah, eina yoshim hashbima ala tropia shebechayei bala. They have no right to ask for a shvua. Even if she has no exemption. Even in a case where the husband didn't grant her an exemption from a shvua, nobody has a right to ask her for a shvua in that case, because it's the Yorshim. And the Yorshim only have one time they can ask her for a shvua. That's the time that she asks for a ketubah. She doesn't ask for a ketubah, they can't ask her all of a sudden to take a shvua on being an apitropis, on being a chenvanit, or an isata, or pilcha, on everything they have no right to ask with. He denies that. That's what the second statement of Rabbi Shimon comes to say according to Rav Papa. That's Rashi's explanation over here. And as Tosafot points out, according to this explanation of Rashi, second half of Rabbi Shimon is not just about the Yorshim, it's even about him himself. That Rabbi Shimon denies the husband's right to ask for a shvua when he appoints his wife, whether as an apitropia, whether as a chenvanit, or even, of course, according to Rabbi Eliezer, he would deny that. And the reason they talked about Yorshim is because of the first half of Rabbi Shimon. The first ever Rabbi Shimon statement, which accords with the explanation of Abaye, over there it had to be talking about Yorshim, because that was particular to the Yorshim. So therefore, in the second statement, he said it about the Yorshim, but it's Lav Dafka, it even applies to the individual himself. And Rav Papa is saying that Rabbi Shimon argues wholesale on that Mishnah before about the husband's right to ask for a Shvuah when he appoints her to work on the estate or to work with any of the assets of the estate. On the other hand, there are other Rishonim, mostly in the word Ella, where many times in the Gemara the word Ella means a rejection of everything that happened previously and now a new explanation. Therefore, they believe that Rav Papa's statement is completely independent of what Abaye said before. And therefore, Rav Papa's statement has nothing to do with Abaye at all, only to do with Rabbi Elezer, Machlokuto. Now, in terms of Psak Halacha, Tosva quotes the Rabbeinu Hananel, and he himself agrees that the Halacha here is like Rabbi Shimon, because the Gemara, in each of the attempts to explain where Rabbi Shimon applied in the Mishnah, they always set up Rabbi Shimon according to the one that we passed an halacha like. Therefore, since the halacha is like Abishol ben Miriam, we set up Rabbi Shimon that way. Since the halacha is like Hanan versus the Bnei Kohanim Gadolim, we set up Rabbi Shimon that way. And that's evidence of the fact that the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon. So just like the halacha is like all those Tanaim that we set up Rabbi Shimon like, so too over here, the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon. And Tosafot actually brings a case law by Rabbeinu Tam, where an instance like this came before the Rabbeinu Tam, and he said that the woman doesn't have to take a Shvua in that case, because the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon. And therefore, if you believe the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon, then how Rav Papa explains Rabbi Shimon becomes very important, whereas the Rif and the Rambam and others say that the halacha here is not necessarily like Rabbi Shimon. He says, according to this, Rabbi Shimon's arguing on a Stam Mishnah, and the halacha is like a Stam Mishnah. And therefore, the explanation here of Rav Papa, of Rabbi Shimon Shita, becomes less important, because the halacha is actually not like the position of Rabbi Shimon. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the bottom of Peichet Amud Bet.